Let's start. So my plan today is to firstly review the Durham theory of integration and Stokes' theorem. Well, we already had questions about that in the tutorial, so you should know a bit about it anyway, but I'm going to remind you a little bit. And then remind you a little bit about how you think about gauge fields in terms of and their curvature and characteristic classes in terms of Durham cohomology. So, if I have an n-dimensional manifold, then locally, and I have an n-form, omega looks like f of x dx1 wedge dxn. In some other coordinates, say x tilde, omega will look like the Jacobian factor times f of x tilde dx tilde 1. So this Jacobian factor is equal to the determinant of del x tilde I xi. All right, no, that looks like that's a lot. So as we were saying at the end of last time, we know that when we do a change of coordinates in integration, we pick up a factor of the absolute value of the Jacobian. So this suggests that up to the difference between Jacobian and its absolute value, an n-form is something we can integrate. So to understand the difference between the Jacobian and its absolute value, we need to know about orientations. So say definition, an orientation on a manifold. This is kind of a crude way of talking about it. Is a collection of local coordinate systems so that the determinant of the Jacobian is positive when we change from one coordinate to another. So, for example, the Mobius band can I even draw the Mobius band? Let's see. Does not admit an orientation. In more like slightly more concrete terms, so if we have a frame E1 to EN locally, then locally it describes an orientation. So a frame is a collection of tangent vectors which form a basis at each point. If I have another frame, fi is a ij ei is another frame. It gives the same orientation. If the determinant of A is positive. So in particular, so we notice the ordering of this, these vectors is crucial, right? Because if I change the ordering, then I'm going to change this matrix by permuting some of the columns. That will change the sign of the determinant. So if, for example, in dimension 2, the frames E1, E2, and E2, E1 give opposite orientations. Because the matrix going from one to the other has determinant minus one. So similarly, in any dimensions, if I change the order, I pick up the sign, which is the determinant of the permutation. Okay, so how do we integrate? Well, let's take a manifold. It looks like this one. So let M be an oriented manifold of dimension n. And omega be an n form. Then we define the integral over m of omega by, so firstly, we cut m into n-dimensional cubes. So for example, in this picture, I'm going to cut my surface into squares like that. I'll tile the whole surface by squares. On each cube, we choose coordinates. Xi, which range from 0 to 1, so that on the overlaps, like the interfaces, maybe better. Between the cubes, the determinant of the Jacobian of, for the change of coordinates is positive. And then we simply define the integral to be the sum over the integral of each cube. And the integral over m omega is the sum over the cubes of the integral of xi 0 to 1. This is the usual n-dimensional integral of omega. Because in these coordinates, omega is equal to f dx1 dxn. So the key point is that this is independent of the choice of the way I cut my manifold up. Okay, any questions?
What goes wrong apart? Well, so there's definitely something that goes wrong with the change of variables formula if I try to integrate on the Mobius strip. But what intuitively, if I try to integrate some scalar function on the Mobius strip and I just cut the Mobius strip at some point and I rectify it and it becomes a rectangle, I just do the integral over that rectangle. Does that depend on the choice of where I cut or what goes wrong?
And so you said you want to try to integrate a scalar function. So that's always going to depend on the choice of coordinates, because when I change coordinates, I get a Jacobian factor. So maybe you could rephrase the question as like, what kind of tensor can I integrate on the Mobius strip? And of course, it's the kind of tensor that will transform as the absolute value of the Jacobian. And there is such a tensor, but it's just not an n form. There's a theory of Dram cohomology with coefficients in a bundle with a flat connection that fits into that theory. Okay, so let me explain this quickly. So suppose I have some local picture where I've cut my manifold into cubes like this. And is there any, yes. And I have some other local picture where I've cut my manifold into cubes in some slightly different way. The integral, the sum of the integral over these cubes, and the sum of the integral over these cubes, these guys both equal the sum of the integral over smaller cubes. Which are the ones which fit in both the white and pink regions. So in other words, I take my cubes to have walls given by both the white lines and the pink ones. And then I get these kind of smaller areas. And I can integrate over those instead. And since for each cube, the answer doesn't depend on the coordinates, so we conclude that the integral over the white way of doing it is the same as the integral over the pink way of doing it. Okay, seem plausible? I just wanted to sketch the idea. And the key point is that in each cube, it doesn't depend on the coordinates. So I take, say, this cube, I get it's the sum of those regions, and those regions I can use the pink coordinates, and then I can rearrange the sum so I get the sum over the pink cubes.
Is this analogous to in analysis when you partition your interval? It doesn't matter how you
Yes.
partition it.
Exactly. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. It's the same exactly like that. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to talk about is Stokes' theorem. So, if M is an oriented n-dimensional manifold with boundary that means there's a picture of such a thing. With boundary means there's a region where it looks like where one of the coordinates takes values on the half line. This means some coordinate patches x1, xn are restricted by say x1 being non-negative. So the instead of having coordinate patches which look like a ball inside of Rn, there are some which look like this kind of region here. Then if I have omega, which is an n minus 1 form, then the integral over m of d omega is equal to the integral over the boundary of m of the pullback of omega, where I is the inclusion. Okay, so should be familiar with this from multivariable calculus. If we're in one dimensions, this is just the fundamental theorem of calculus. I have an interval that has a boundary. If I'm in two dimensions or three dimensions, people give them different names. I forget Green's theorem on the plane or whatever. But this is the general form. Turns out not to be hard to prove at all, actually. But that. To understand the statement, we need to know the integral over M is defined once I've chosen an orientation on M. But once I integrate over the boundary, we have to understand how the boundary has an orientation. The boundary has an orientation which comes from that on M. So let me explain how that is. That arises. Well, so on the boundary, there's some little region in the boundary. We can choose a frame E1 up to EN near the boundary. So that E1 up to EN minus 1 are parallel and EN is inward pointing. So in dimension 2, I want to say that's E1 and that's E2. Is E2 points in from the boundary? This is my surface, and E1 is parallel to the boundary. So if this is an oriented frame, a frame compatible with the orientation on the manifold, then this one will be a frame on the boundary. And at this point, there's like a bunch of sign conventions, and I tend to get them wrong. So perhaps this was meant to be outward pointing. Yeah. Let me just say that there's some annoying signs that we can correct later. So for example, if I have the disk and so in two dimensions, to give an orientation is to tell you which way do I rotate. Do I rotate clockwise or anti-clockwise? It's a choice like that. So if this is my oriented frame in two dimensions, so that I'm rotating anti-clockwise, then with these conventions, if I bring this kind of this to the boundary, and I want E2 to be inward pointing, I can rotate this near the boundary so that you know, it looks like that. E1, and that's still an anti-clockwise rotation. So with these conventions, E1 points that around that way, so the orientation on the boundary goes that way. Okay, that makes sense. And there's a similar story in higher dimensions, it's just harder to visualize. So I know we want to get on to the actual topic of the course. Just thought it was important to understand this material properly first. Now, what's the proof of Stokes' theorem? Well, we'll divide M into cubes, so that the integral over m of d omega is the sum over the cubes of the integral over the cube, which is just the integral from x1, xn, goes from 0 to 1 of d omega. And now we're first going to analyze each piece here. And for each piece here, we're just going to use standard fundamental theorem of calculus. So on each cube, omega is equal to the sum fi1 i n minus 1 dx i1 dx i n. So d omega is equal to the sum df I1 I n dxj dxj wedge dx I1 wedge dxin. Which is the sum epsilon j I1 in df I1 in xj dx1 wedge dxn. Okay? So now, what we're going to do is just integrate over the cube this function, d omega, which is obviously a total derivative. Like each component. Depending on what value this index j takes, it's a total derivative in one of the directions. Because we're doing a multiple integral over n variables, we can use Fabini's theorem and integrate one of them at a time. So let's see how we do that. So I'm going to fix my cube again. I'm going to do the integral from x1, xn, going from 0 to 1, of that expression. Epsilon j, I1, in, epsilon is the alternating symbol, df, I1. Sorry, that should be n, that index should be n minus 1 there, sorry. Oh, yeah, thank you. So how do I do this? I just integrate over the xj variable. And we get the sum over j of the integral of epsilon j I1 I n minus 1 f I1 I n minus 1. And I'm going to integrate over xi is not equal, xi where I is not equal to j. And there's two contributions. Xj is equal to 1 minus the same thing. Xj is equal to 0. So all I've done is use the fundamental theorem of calculus, apply to that total derivative. And now let's look at this apparently complicated formula and draw a picture. Here's my cube. This integral is simply the sum of the boundary components. Because for each j, I'm going to choose the top or the bottom. So here, j, here there's two, it's a two-dimensional integral. So this is equal to the sum over the boundary components of the cube. Of the integral of omega restricted to the boundary. Okay. So we're almost done. So any questions? We're going pretty fast. This material. So the only thing left to do is to say, what happens if we have a complicated manifold and I'd have to do this thing on each cube? Well, the fun thing is, if I have an interesting manifold, every boundary of the cube appears twice, one from that side and one from the other side. And the contributions just cancel. Except for those which live let me leave that up there and erase this on the boundary of the manifold itself. So here I'm going to draw a kind of a local picture of my manifold cut into cubes in some way. So if I do the sum over the cubes of the integral of d omega, we get a sum of contributions from the boundary components of each cube of the integral of omega. Now the key point . If I have an interface between two cubes, like this, this interface here in blue appears twice. With the opposite sign. So that the interfaces which are in the middle of the manifold, they just vanish. However, there's some boundary components which don't cancel because they appear just at the boundary of the manifold. So they don't cancel. Except for those which live on the boundary of M. And because everything here cancels, we conclude okay. So to sum up, this formula, the Stokes theorem, is actually nothing more difficult than putting together three simple facts. Integrals transform under the with the Jacobian factor. Well, two facts, really, and also the fundamental theorem of calculus. OK, any questions? So as I said, I probably got a couple of signs wrong. But you can kind of figure out where the signs come in. What you have to do is think carefully about the cubes which touch the boundary, and what sign do I get for the integral of the faces of that cube which live on the boundary. And those signs come from the fundamental theorem of calculus. And you want to match those signs with the signs coming from the chosen orientation of the boundary. So, I want to move on to introduce, discuss the Trun-Simons action. So M is a manifold. A gauge field. Locally on M, for some the algebra B is an expression A sum AA TA, where TA is a basis of G, and these coefficients are one forms in it. In other words, A is a one form on M tensor G. So there's a word of caution. So there's a phenomenon which I won't have time to discuss today, is that not all gauge fields can have such a global expression like this. They only have an expression like this locally, and they're glued together by gauge transformations. So examples are Dirac's magnetic monopole is something which is not, you know, there's a Yang-Mills field strength, but it the actual Yang-Mills field can only be defined locally. But okay, that's, we'll discuss that in detail another day. The curvature of A is defined to be, well, this is a two form on M, valued in G. DAA plus half FABC like that, or FABC are the structure constants of the Lie. So I mentioned that there was an issue with defining the gauge field globally. It might only have a local expression. The field strength is, of course, much better behaved. So even for a topologically non-trivial bundle, this field strength makes sense. Makes sense. So FA is a two form on M with coefficients in G. So the Bianchi identity tells us the following, that D of F of A plus F of A B C A B wedge F of A C is equal to zero. So this is the covariant derivative with respect to this connection. And it's not hard to check. You look at the formula, you use the Jacobi identity, the fact that a Ram operator squares to zero, and you can deduce this equation very quickly. So I want to deduce the Chern-Simons action, which is very closely related to a characteristic class called the Pontryagin class, or the instanton number. And that's defined to be F wedge F, really. So we can form for form, kappa AB FAA wedge FAB, where kappa is a Killing form, now this is just a plain four form and it has no Lie algebra indices whatsoever. Okay, any questions?
Please repeat how we can get the Bianchi identities, please.
Sure. So I said I'm maybe apologize if I'm going the wrong level because I'm not sure what material you guys have covered and have not covered. So you get the Bianchi identity. So we look at this expression for the curvature, and I take d of f a. D has two. The curvature has two terms, so d has two terms. One of them is d squared of a, and the other is d applied to that a wedge a term. Now, the Durham operator is a derivation for the wedge product, so I get it will distribute, so I'll get two, that in turn will lead to two terms. I'll get f dA wedge a, f a wedge dA. Well, to a sign, they're the same. So I'll get something like f dA wedge a. And now I look at this expression. This will have an a wedge dA, which looks a lot like what we found from here, and they will cancel. And I will have another term, which is a wedge a wedge a. Now, the wedge product is totally anti-symmetric. So I'll get some totally anti-symmetric expression with these Lie algebra structure constants. And that will vanish using the Jacobi identity.
OK. What do you mean by a non-trivial function?
Okay, so why don't Caleb, why don't I explain that in detail now? Because I was thinking doing that the next lecture, but actually would fit in pretty well now. So so the first thing to understand is how gauge transformations act, which you should have seen before, but maybe using different notation. So if I have some x, which is a map from my manifold to the group, so if you like, let's be concrete and take the group to be SUN, and the Lie algebra to be little SUN. And if I have a one form, tensor G, then a gauge transformation sends A to x inverse dx plus x inverse ax. So let's try and make this more concrete. So in coordinates, dxi times t a times aia. So where ta These are just n by n Hermitian matrices, trace free. So an x of is a function of the xi, which lives in the group SUN. So this is a matrix, it's a unitary matrix with determinant 1. So x inverse dx is simply the sum of x inverse times d by dxi x dxi. This expression here, for any unitary matrix x, if I differentiate it, take it multiplied by its inverse, I'll get a Hermitian matrix. This expression is in the Lie algebra SUN. So this is the form we need to get a gauge field. Does that make sense? And what's the other term? Is the sum of dxi. Let me write this. So let me write this slightly differently. I hope it's okay. I'll call this mi. Where mi is a Hermitian matrix. So this is like a collection of n Hermitian matrices. That's what a gauge field looks like. X inverse x, x inverse ax is I just conjugate the mi's by this unitary matrix. Okay, so this is what so we should have seen before in a quantum field theory class. In this notation, this is what a gauge transformation looks like. So the idea of having a non-trivial bundle is that on some coordinate patches, you have a collection of coordinate patches. On each coordinate patch, you have a gauge field. But on different coordinate patches, these gauge fields are not the same, but they're related by, by a gauge transformation. I'll give you an example in a minute. So we have a manifold M. And UI, some coordinate patches. And on each one, we have AI, which is a one form on UI tensor SUN. This is our local gauge field. So if UI intersect UJ is not empty, then on the intersection, we have a gauge transformation. I'll call it xij. And what you wanted to do is transform the gauge field ai on patch I to the gauge field aj on patch j. Well, ai is xij inverse aj xij. So you might think that's all you need, but then if you think a little harder, you'll realize that if I have three coordinate patches which intersect, I might have two different ways of getting a gauge transformation from one to the other. And that's too much. You want those to be the same. So if ui, uj, uk intersect, well, then I can write ai as, let me say this.
There's a term missing, right?
Sorry. Thank you. So I'm not gonna mess up your notes. I want to switch this a little bit. I want to make this a gauge transformation going, which takes I and spits out J rather than the other way around. Well, I can write AK as, well, like it's a gauge transformation of AI directly, or I can first write it as a gauge transformation of AJ, which is in turn a gauge transformation of AI. So I can write AK as, I'll use this expression, xik minus 1, ai plus diagonal operator, xik. Or I can also write it as, it's a longer expression, xjk minus 1 times aj. And, well, AJ itself can be written in terms of AI. So if you know how gauge transformations compose, we'll get XJK minus 1, XIJ minus 1, AIC, XIJ, XJK. So in other words, AK is written as a gauge transformation of AJ, which is itself a gauge transformation of AI. So AK is the composed gauge transformation of AI. So we get these two ways of writing AK in terms of a gauge transformation of AI, and they have to be the same. So we need the co-cycle condition. Is that xik is xij xjk. So this is what some having a non-trivial bundle is, that we can have these gauge transformations. We will typically not be able to find a global expression for A. Rather, we have these local expressions glued together by gauge transformations. Okay? Yeah.
Why did we choose the gauge transformation the way it is, these two terms, and not the terms? Is it true?
Yeah, so, well, what you want to do is, the fundamental thing is really not this A that I've written. The fundamental thing is the covariant derivative. So the covariant derivative associated to A is equal to the usual derivative in some direction I, xi plus ai ata. So this is an expression which acts on a field. Say we're in the case of SUN, I have an n-component field, this is an n by n matrix. This is an expression which will act on an incompletely field by differentiating and hitting it with this matrix. So this acts on like n complex components. Now, a gauge transformation x from my manifold to SUN will permute the n components by a unitary matrix. Now, if I take A and I apply a gauge transformation, so I'll call like this is equal to A after the gauge transformation. Then you have this formula. So the covariant derivative after the gauge transformation is the same as conjugating the original gauge transformation by just this matrix which permutes the fields.
I'm assuming you're working on the adjoint representation for that.
No, this works the fields live in, say, the vector representation of SUN, and this is a matrix. This acts on the vector representation, this acts on the vector representation, and this acts on the vector representation. So it's really like a composition of matrices.
I feel if I'm in a fundamental representation, I just need just x on one side. I need to do like by conjugation. So that was the adjoint.
I don't?
Yeah. And the correct physicist's point of view, they say the covariant derivative should transform like the field. But if I'm on that representation, the group just act just by multiplication. So
it's a question of terminology.
Yeah.
Yes. I see. Like is acting on the right, okay. The adjoint representation is conjugation. So I'm not going to use when I talk about the adjoint representation, I will normally write it by conjugation.
Okay.
Of matrix, because I'm thinking of things as matrices.
Okay.
Just to make sure, n doesn't need to be the dimension of the manifold, does it?
Oh, sorry. No, this is independent of the dimension of the manifold. Yeah. So what's the? I think the intuition here should be like fairly clear. Like the, you know, I could, this could be U1 instead of SUN. You had a one component field, it's like the photon, and then the gauge field. Sorry, I can't get back. The one component field is the electron, and except it's a spinner, not a scalar. The gauge field is a photon, which allows you to compare the phase at different points. And the gauge transformation is just at every point in space-time, I do a phase change. What does that do to the covariant derivative? That's what the gauge transformation is. Yeah.
Does this works only for finite dimensional groups, or can we do it? Can we do for infinite?
You can do it for infinite dimensional groups, and it really happens in nature. Suppose we're doing Kaluza-Klein reduction. Then the gauge field downstairs will also depend on the extra spacetime coordinates. So it will look like an infinite dimensional group, a group of loops or something like that. Any other questions? I didn't get to write an example of a non-trivial bundle. I don't think I have time, but it's not hard to do it on the two-sphere. We can do it tomorrow.